Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.
Shrink Wrap Radio number 129, Process Work, December 28th, 2007. Welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio, the planet's premier psychology podcast. This is your host, Dr. Dave, coming to you from the San Francisco Bay Area. Shrink Wrap Radio is the show that speaks from the psychologist in me to the psychologist in you, whether you be amateur, student, or professional.
I think process work is very much interested in the dreaming process. Awareness as a vehicle to pick up and unfold our less conscious experiences. And I think that starts to diverge a bit from Gestalt. We put a lot of emphasis on the altered states of consciousness in the sense that becoming aware of the subtle experiences we're having is like sometimes focusing on unusual states of consciousness or unusual states of mind.
That was the voice of my guest, Julie Diamond, Ph.D. Julie Diamond, Ph.D. is part of the original group who helped develop process-oriented psychology, also known as process work. She co-authored its international training program and its Master of Arts degree programs in Portland, Oregon, based on its teachings. About process work, Julie writes, "Process work is based on the simple yet profound premise that the fluid transfer of information and experience between subjective, imaginative states of mind and our everyday objective, rational mind is critical for our psychological and physical well-being. Research into consciousness, health, creativity, and psychology increasingly supports this idea that the mind is much more than our everyday rational intelligence. The power of emotions, feelings, fantasies, dreams, and other so-called non-linear or non-rational states of consciousness play a key role in our physical health, emotional stability, and psychological well-being," end quote. Julie helps individuals and organizations and communities embrace change, challenges, and conflict as vehicles of growth. She's a longtime colleague and student of Jungian analyst Dr. Arnold Mindell, and is one of the original founders of the Research Society for Process-Oriented Psychology in Zurich, Switzerland, and the Process Work Center in Portland, Oregon. Julie has been a central figure in developing learning centers for process-oriented psychology in Switzerland, North America, Australia, and New Zealand. She's the author, with Lee Spark Jones, of A Path Made by Walking, Process Work in Theory and Practice, a comprehensive and widely used textbook on process work theory and methods. She has written several articles on the psychology of democracy. Her article, A Democracy Dialogue, Getting to the Essence of Freedom, explores how psychology's subtlest reaches expand democracy beyond freedom from constraint to the freedom of self-actualization. Julie is currently working on a new book, A User's Guide to Power. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Julie Diamond, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thanks, David. It's great to be here.
Now, you're a longtime student of Arne Mindell in something called process work. So let's start off by having you tell us something about Arne Mindell and the approach known as process work.
Sure. Well, Arne Mindell began, if we go right back to the beginning, his first career was as a physicist. And while he was doing postgraduate research in Zurich, Switzerland, he, I would say, stumbled into Jungian psychology.
Interesting.
It is interesting. He tells the story in a number of his books, Riding the Horse Backwards, I believe he talks about it, and also in some interviews, that he began to have dreams or nightmares, he said, and someone referred him to a therapist. He didn't know anything about dreams or dream work or even psychology, and it turns out that the dream therapist that he got recommended to work with was Marie-Louise von Franz.
Oh, yes. Famous Jungian.
Exactly. One of Jung's most famous students. And so that led him on a very interesting path where he actually switched careers and went and studied at the Jung Institute and became an analytic psychologist and got his PhD in psychology. But actually, he spent a lot of his time trying to weave together his studies in physics with his studies in psychology, and he's still at it. His latest books, in fact, really, for example, The Quantum Mind and Healing, talk about kind of a unified approach to understanding both physical as well as psychic and emotional phenomenon. And in his mind, that there really shouldn't be separate explanations to understand the universe, that people and objects and matter and energy and light, that all of this really, in an ideal world, should have one theory behind it all. So Arnie started, just to come back to how he developed process work, while he was working with dreams, he began to experiment with people's body experiences. He had a number of patients who were ill, and he, in working with them on their experience of the illness, he discovered that the person's experience of their body, their pains, their illness, their sensations, were very much like dreams, that they were expressions of the unconscious. And so his first book, he talks about this in The Dream Body. He puts it together. He says there's not just dreams in the body, but there's one so-called field, the dreaming field, and that this can be experienced in many ways, in the body, at nighttime, in dreams, obviously in projections and relationships, that we're constantly sending out all kinds of subtle signals and messages, and the body itself is doing this, and that it's full of information for us to decode, just like a dream is.
Okay, so from dreams, which I'll probably want to talk to you about some more, tell us how that expanded into something more generic called process work.
Right. Well, in the early days, it was called dream body work, and because the emphasis was really on the body and the body's experience on illness, on symptoms, and their link to dreams. And as Arnie began to follow this, he discovered that it's not just the body, but it's all kinds of ways that the unconscious is expressing itself. And he was more interested in the expression itself, that these dream-like or dreaming phenomena were communicated in various ways, channels he called them. So he put the emphasis, or he switched the emphasis, not just to the duality of the dream or the body as the vehicles for expression, but on the dreaming process itself. So process, the flow of information and the flow of experience that we're always tracking and or not tracking, as the case may be, became more of the emphasis. And so he called it process-oriented psychology, and it picked up kind of a nickname of process work over the years. And taking the emphasis off psychology, probably while it was not intended as such, its usage is so broad. Process work is applied in so many different ways. It has a group application, an organizational application, relationships, family, all kinds of a conflict resolution application. So to take it away from psychology and to see it more broadly as facilitation, I think that's reflected in the name process work.
Yes, and I'm going to want to explore some of those other applications as we get into this. And I have to say that initially the term process work was a little misleading for me. It kind of threw me off because it's a term that I've used, and I don't know if I'm the only person that's used it, but in connection with other sorts of work, there are other theoretical approaches, I think, that also emphasize the importance of tracking one's inner process. One that comes to mind is Gestalt therapy, and from your description of at least the therapeutic part, it kind of sounds like Gestalt therapy. Are you familiar enough with Gestalt to kind of make a distinction or not?
I can weigh in on that, because a lot of people have said over the years that it reminds them of Gestalt, and in fact, some of our faculty were trained in Gestalt and now are using process work, and in fact, the Mindells, I believe in the late, gosh, I don't know when that was, I think it was the late 80s or early 90s, spent time in residence at Esalen, where, as you know, Gestalt really took off.
Sure, Fritz Perls was there
exactly.
For several years, yes.
Exactly, and many people there said, well, wait a minute, that looks a lot like Gestalt. What mm-hmm. do you know, what's the difference? How do you see the difference?
Right.
And without getting too technical, there are some differences. I I, not being an expert in Gestalt, I'm a little hesitant to say what they are. I think fundamentally our emphasis, well, one of the things in common is the focus on awareness, of becoming aware.
Right.
Of yourself, of your different parts, of your communication. I think there's a lot of similarity there. I think process work is very much interested in the dreaming process, awareness as a vehicle to pick up and unfold our less conscious experiences. And I think that starts to diverge a bit from Gestalt. We put a lot of emphasis on the altered states of consciousness in the sense that becoming aware of the subtle experiences we're having is like sometimes focusing on unusual states of consciousness or unusual states of mind.
These are all topics I'm very interested in, I have to let
okay.
you know.
But okay.
I'm very interested in altered states of consciousness, which I some of my own doctoral work was on, and also dream work, because I've taught classes on it. So I'm going to want to drill down on that a little bit.
Okay.
But just to back up,
best.
But not to put you on the spot. It's not like I'm coming off as the world expert. Believe me, I'm still a student of all of this, and I'm very interested to learn more about this approach. But you noted that Mendel's original background was in physics, not in psychology, and I believe you told me that your PhD is not in psychology. Was that right?
That's correct. My PhD is in sociolinguistics. I did a study in pragmatics or human communication.
So I'm wondering, so how did you come to be involved in process work and now the training of psychotherapists?
I kind of, so to speak, hopped a freight train to Zurich. I was doing undergraduate work. I was a student at Antioch College in the 70s, and there was a professor, Ben Thompson, who was an education professor, and I was an education major at the time, and he and Arnie Mendel had met, I believe, once mm-hmm. at a conference and had completely clicked, and I think they'd spent all of an hour together talking, and then they began this correspondence, and at the time, Arnie was working on a manuscript, his very first manuscript that he wrote, which was later published as The Shaman's Body. And he sent this original manuscript to Ben Thompson, and they went back and forth. And Ben loved it, and he would read sections of this in his classes out loud. And he talked a great deal about this fellow, this Jungian analyst, Arnie Mendel, in Zurich. And a number of my friends were also in the same class, and Antioch had is quite a progressive, or was, it's just been in the news recently, it's actually struggling, but has quite a progressive educational philosophy. So this professor encouraged several of us to design a study and to go to Zurich. And so
how exciting.
I
was just saying, how exciting for you that must have been.
It was very exciting, and I wasn't really that interested in psychology. I was much more interested in political philosophy and education, and I would have to say I was a little bit more on the political side of things. But I thought, well, that's kind of exciting, and going to Europe, and why not? So what was originally intended to be a three-month semester turned into 10 years.
Wow.
So I ended up going there, and I graduated from Antioch while I was still living in Zurich. And while in Zurich, I started to get very interested. At that point, Arnie was doing a lot of work. He was training people at the Institute and also holding seminars for students and some non-students or some people who were interested but not enrolled at the Jung Institute. And as he was starting to develop a methodology for tracking the body experiences, and he was talking a lot about signals and channels and the flow of information and the flow of experience, and something in me clicked. I got very fascinated by communication theory and by thinking in terms of signals and signal exchange and nonverbal and verbal communication. And to be honest, at that point, to stay living in the country, I had to enroll at the university because it was one of the ways that people could get an ability to work and live in Switzerland. So don't tell anybody.
Okay. It's just between you and me.
It's just between you and me. I originally enrolled in the university for the student work permit, but I ended up studying linguistics and communication and pragmatics, and I ended up doing my doctorate, and that's how that's how I made the leap into that field. For me, that was psychology. I have to say, I never understood when I looked at what psychology was. To me, human communication and verbal and nonverbal experiences and expressions and group dynamics and all of that, that to me was psychology, and I never understood why I had to be in another field to study it. So.
Sure. Sure. Now, I'm just curious, is Arnie Mandel, is he Swiss or was he from somewhere else?
He's from Schenectady, New York.
Interesting.
He was over there doing his graduate work at the Swiss Institute of Technology, which is the Swiss Polytechnical Institute, the ETH, which is sort of the equivalent of the MIT over there. And he was actually at MIT, and he went over there for this postgraduate study program.
Well, that's fascinating, because I have to say he does keep popping up on my radar screen, where I was leading workshops in Ireland, for example, and people were saying, oh, well, do you know Arnie Mandel? And you know, and then other people have come up and said, well, I'm doing something based on Arnie Mandel. And so I'm really pleased to have the chance to meet you and to find out more about it. And as you know, I'll be interviewing him probably sometime next year. So, but let's go on. Let's get back to the dream work, which is where he started, and I know you know something about that.
Just to say, David, what you just said about how he pops up a lot, I think also maybe because process work has such diverse applications. So you might find his name pops up in the field of conflict resolution, but then it pops up in the field of palliative care and working with death and dying or something like that. And I think that's one of the interesting things about process work and Arnie Mandel is the breadth of application.
Yeah, that really is fascinating. Well, the work started with dreams, and so what I'm wondering about is, if I were to watch him or you work with somebody's dream, what would that look like? How would that approach differ from, there's so many other approaches out there. What would it look like?
Well, honestly, it would probably look like every approach, kind of sequentially in a way, because as the word process implies, it's really a client-centered or process-centered approach, so it really follows the person and their experience, and everyone tells a dream. So when you hear a dream, you don't just hear the dream and its content, but what comes with it is something like a set of operating instructions, if you will. The person's also communicating to you how they would work on or how they would unravel the meaning of the dream. They may use their hands a lot, or they may focus in on the language of it, or they may have a deep feeling experience of it, or they may go to great lengths to describe certain images. So they're really showing you how it is they enter the dream, and that's one of the ways that we key into dream work, is that we notice, how does the person talk about it? What are they doing? Where is their energy? What channels, so to speak, or modes of representation are they using to get into their own dream? And so it would begin with that. So it may look like drawing. It may look like movement work or expression, kinesthetic expression. It may look like dialogue or a role play if people emphasize heavily the interaction between dream figures. So it really will have a lot of different techniques that can be employed.
Interesting.
Because of that basic principle. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so, and also it was described as a mind-body approach. So in terms of dream work, then that might come out how?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, that in following how the person tells the dream, that is in effect, that's the body, that how they use their body, how they express it, not just verbally but non-verbally. That's the whole domain of the body. And that is as significant, if not more, than what they say about it. So to how we train people in process work is we train them to really develop a very keen understanding of signals and subtle feedback processes where somebody has a lot of energy or there's a lot of body tension or emotionality. And by following and focusing on that, we're really using the body to help unfold the dream. as well, I just should add, as well as that the intellectual understanding of a dream is very satisfying, but there's also something around, there's a deeper aha when you really get it at a visceral level, and I think that's also where body work comes in to dream work, by actually feeling yourself or feeling your way into a dream symbol, not just thinking about it, but literally becoming it or shape-shifting it or feeling it as an expression or as a movement or as a gesture. These things have a very powerful effect on our ability to understand.
Yes.
It really expands cognitive understanding.
Yes, and again, it does make me think a lot of Gestalt therapy and how they might sometimes work with a dream, which would be very body-oriented. You know, they might.
That's right.
Yeah. Be the doorknob.
Right, exactly. Yeah. But we would say, we would notice where the doorknob is happening. That's that we may also direct someone to pick up a role, but in part of the dream work, we might notice as the person talks about the doorknob, are they using their hands? Is their posture shifting? Do they do something with their muscles? And we would catch it happening in their body in the moment and help them put their focus and awareness on it. So we kind of try to catch the organic roles as they appear in the moment.
Yeah. Now, people who do this work, do they do it primarily as a form of group therapy or one-on-one?
Well, that's a good question. That's another good question. what we do have, there is a process work approach to working with groups directly, and that's the theory of that is often referred to as world work, though you could also say process work with groups, where working with a group, whether it's a conflict situation or just simply helping a group with its a teamwork problem or if it's a visioning or sorting through issues, that process work does have a direct set of methods for working with groups and their issues. But you can also do process work, individual work, one-to-one, and you can also do group therapy with process work where people work one-on-one, like on the hot seat, as they say in Gestalt, or coming into the middle working with a facilitator. A lot of the seminars and a lot of the training is done in groups like that. So both are used. If you do go to a process work facilitator, chances are it'll be one-to-one. Though I have to say, I don't know, there's so many process work facilitators now, and some of them may just be working exclusively in groups. I don't know.
Okay. Now, you, in fact, you're the director of training and program development at the Process Work Institute of Portland, Oregon. Mm-hmm. What's your approach to training? What have you found that works best in the training process?
Oh, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. I really have to say, I think it's funny because I was just talking about how I got to Zurich and I was saying I was an education major. And I think really, I'm, you know, with all my various parts and interests, deep down, I'm probably an educator. And the more I know, the less I know. I think it's one of the most mysterious things is how people learn and how people grow and what can be taught and what can only be grown. And when you talk about teaching someone to help other people, to be a facilitator of human experience, it gets really mysterious because you have to really know yourself so much. And I know this is a big political debate in the field of psychology, you know, but we feel very strongly in process work that in order to work with other people and to be able to help them with their awareness, that you really have to understand yourself and have a ongoing practice of self-awareness and self-reflection. And so I think that, and that's, you know, a part of our training is that we ask that people work with themselves and to do their own therapy work, but also to through interaction with their peers and in groups to really get to know themselves, where their triggers are, how they can stay detached and centered even under pressure. And that has its own timing. You can't really program that. You know, we have a 4-year training program, but who's to say that things like that develop in 4 years? The timing of how people develop is can't be pushed. I think that's a mystery. So I'm probably not answering your question, but making it more complex.
Well, I love the distinction that you made between, you said some things can be taught and other things need to be grown. And yes. I just love that distinction, that metaphor.
I do think that some things need to be grown, and that we really believe that people's dreams really direct what they need to be learning. You know, you don't pick up everything. You know, you can read a book and forget it right away. You can read a book and it has a profound influence on the rest of your life. And that's a question of what in you, what you're ready for, or what turns you on in any given moment. So a lot of our training is highly experiential, and there's a lot of mentoring, and we allow students to also choose the people that they want to work with more closely, because we feel that that's really important, that you'll work better and deeper with someone who you feel an alliance with.
Are we talking about a full-time, four-year training where people are going to school every day of the week, or you know, what? How is the structure, or are these professionals who come, you know, once a month? Or
yeah, the latter. We have, we just changed our program. We used to have a completely self-directed, self-guided, unstructured program where the student really chose their advisors or their committee, and together they could really basically study however they wanted. I mean, they could take classes. They could take classes where they live. They could come to Portland and take classes. And for years, that was very well loved, because it really honored the individual's process. But as things changed, people found it harder and harder to do that and to blend a professional life with that. And also the sense of unstructuredness was really difficult for people. So we just changed it to a cohort-based system where we have residential periods of study four times a year in Portland.
Okay, and are there any sorts of prerequisites or professional credentials that people need to have to take that training program?
No, one of the kind of radical, or I would say educationally progressive values that process work has had from the beginning is that academic skill is not always a prerequisite for who has a good touch with people.
Yeah.
And that while being credentialed in the world, that mainstream recognition does require academic degrees, and we support people to get them. This program that I'm discussing, the one that certifies people to be, we have other programs as well, but this program that certifies people to be a certified process work facilitator doesn't require an academic background. We do have a track in our program that grants a master's degree in process work in addition, and to enter that track, they're like parallel tracks, you do need a Bachelor of Arts degree. But just the diploma program, you need, you go through an interview process and you write an essay, and that one of the things that we look at very strongly is that we want to see that your inner world supports this decision, that it's not just a conscious intention, so to speak, or a good idea, but that your dreams and that your innermost self is really almost guided to that decision. And so there's kind of a rigorous interview procedure.
Okay, well, just one last question about the training program. You mentioned a master's degree. Is that through some accredited institution?
We are in the process of accrediting it. We actually grant our own degree. We're authorized in the state of Oregon, so we have two degrees. We have a Master's of Arts degree in the Conflict Facilitation and Organizational Change, which is that world work strand of process work, and then we have a Master's degree in process work, both authorized by the state of Oregon. And we're just old enough now. You have to be in existence for a certain number of years and have had more than one degree. So we're just in the position now to start the accreditation process. And as being a very tiny school, it's been difficult to bring the resources to bear on that journey. But I think we think it's really well worth it. So we're starting that process now.
Okay. Well, I was looking at your website on the internet, and I noticed there that you had conducted some training with the Portland Police Department. Tell us about that. That sounds intriguing.
I did. I feel very fortunate about that. I guess this is the part of me that's interested in communication, and one of the things that I've always really been interested in is the degree of training that I have felt that police officers need to deal with crisis situations. That, in a way, for me, policing is the ultimate facilitation job. And a number of years ago, I started to connect with some of the people on the police force who were involved in training, and discovered that it was a real closed shop, basically, that police had their own trainings and they had their own department and that they weren't really soliciting bids from outside trainers. But I did get in touch with a woman who had created the crisis intervention training, the original one, which is a Memphis, which was formed in the Memphis Police Department about 15 years ago, and it was really developed by the National Alliance of Mental Illness, NAMI. And or I think it's the National Alliance for the Mentally Ill, NAMI. Anyway, they had a training that taught police officers how to respond to people in experiencing crisis, or whether that was drug-induced, or whether someone was under a state of extreme distress, or someone was experiencing extreme states or altered states of consciousness, what's called mental illness. And we had a tragedy in Portland about a year ago where a schizophrenic man was killed while in custody with the police. And after that, there was a big outcry for more training for the police. So this woman contacted me and several others, and I was lucky to be on a team of about, I would say, 5 to 8 people who designed a new training program that became mandatory training for the whole police force. And I started to train, and now I was more the helping to design it in the background. I did some of the initial training, but now that training is monthly and it's going to go on for 2 years, so I've stepped back from the actual delivering of the training.
That's how I
got in there.
Yeah, in what way was that training, or is that training influenced by process work?
Well, it's kind of a blend of many things, and I came in there, the police department did not really, you know, call out for a process work facilitator. The person had met me and knew my background, but it was the particular interest in nonverbal communication and being able to put my skills with nonverbal communication together with crisis, working with people in states of crisis. And I think that's the piece where process work really influenced the training, was really teaching the officers how to understand, for example, when people are escalating, their signals, they're communicating that their signals of distress or upsetness or whatever are not being received. And by tracking how to connect with someone at that nonverbal level in order to de-escalate a situation was the piece that I feel I introduced that's really has its roots in process work.
And I don't know if you can describe this briefly or not, but how would you track such a person to communicate that you were getting their signal?
To use communication theory, so, you know, sort of how I taught it was I would say, you know, a signal, someone sends a message, and when they know their message is received, they stop sending it. And if someone continues to send a message, let's say, then it's because it's not being received. So I just showed how, for example, we used a lot of videos of cops. It's a TV show where they film real-life cop situations.
Right.
It's a great resource for teaching, by the way.
Yeah, I'll bet.
And there was a great example where this woman's sister was in a crisis state and had threatened someone in the family with a knife and threatened the mother. And the sister, and she was taken away, and the officers were standing around, and the sister was yelling at the officer, you know, she came after my mother, and I called up, and no one came yesterday, and she did just kind of very distressed, very, very distressed. And the officer responded in a very rational, ma'am, just basically putting her off. Just, you know, she was screaming and distressed and crying. She was very fearful for the life of her mother because her sister had threatened to kill her mother, and this has happened several times. And the officer responded only to the content, to the verbal level, by sort of addressing the complaint, saying, well, when we came yesterday, we didn't see any signs of force or whatever, can't remember. But he wasn't responding to the tone of voice, to the raised volume, to the sort of rising hysteria, to the tears in her eyes, to her clenched, you know, fists.
How should he have responded to those things? Should he have just said, I see that you're very upset?
Exactly. Actually, uh-huh. that's just what happened.
Uh-huh.
And you could see that every time he responded to the content, she escalated. And it's a great, this video is really, you know, sort of in my mind because it was classic.
Yeah.
She was upset, he responded factually, and she escalated. Then he responded another factual, cool comment, and she escalated again. And then finally he said, I really see you're upset. I'm really sorry. I can really see you're upset. And she just went right down.
Mm.
And it's simple. It's not rocket science. But just mm-hmm. saying, wow, I see you're upset, or this is really hard for you, or whatever, people feel, oh, I'm met. They get it. They're not just blowing me off.
Yeah, yeah. Now, earlier you mentioned how this process has grown into working with conflict, not just at the level that a police department might deal with, but even on a much larger political scale and so on. And it's grown into something that you folks are calling world work, which, you know, sounds pretty ambitious. So,
it does, doesn't it?
Yeah. So
yeah.
Where is world work being applied? Is it being used in, for example, any international conflict situations?
Yes, it is, actually. It's interesting. It has a lot of applications, and it's also the name of a biennial conference that's held around the world with people, about 200 to 300 people come, and it's a training and a kind of like a training seminar, but also it's an opportunity for people from all over to come and to work on issues pertaining to the world, or to their issues, the socio-political issues. The next one's coming up, I should mention, in London in April. So just because I'm on the radio here, the website for that is www.worldwork.org if you're interested in the seminar. But world work is also a body of a set of skills and a theoretical framework for understanding group processes and organizational processes. And some of my colleagues, I used it. For example, I would say that my work with the police department was using world work principles, conflict principles. I used it. I was part of a 3-year enterprise development project in the former Yugoslavian Republic of Macedonia, helping labor unions, the labor union there, transition to a democratic structure. So I worked with kind of the conflict between the teams and the different stakeholders of that project.
Interesting. That sounds like significant work.
That was very fascinating work. That was challenging and fascinating. I have a colleague who's working, who has just returned from Montenegro, working with the UN Commission on High Commission on Refugees, helping sort of conflicts in the department there. Other colleagues are working in companies and businesses, doing organizational development. It has a team building.
What if a listener wanted to get involved in that sort of work? I know I have a certain number of students and graduate students who listen. How would somebody begin to, you know, a lot of us want to do good work in the world, something that's going to make a difference, and this sounds like maybe it has that potential.
Yeah, and I think that's why it has such an ambitious title. I think it matches the sense of urgency that we feel around the world and its situation, and I know a lot of people feel really strongly, and in fact, in psychology, I know a lot of people feel sometimes frustrated that they want to make a big impact, or they mm-hmm. want to impact things at a larger level. And while one-to-one work is really vital, and I really believe that, I think also working on these large socio-political issues is also really compelling. We run a master's program, a 3-year master's program, on this particular work. So if you go to the website, Process Work website, www.processwork.org, click on training, you'll see our training in this master's degree. And we also have shorter courses on this. So as well, there's a lot of, again, if you go to the World Work website, there's a big conference coming up in London. And once you hook into the Process Work website, you'll also see we have a list of all the faculty and all the people around the world doing the work. So each faculty member has their own website or schedule, and you can kind of see where different courses are being held.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, as we begin to wrap things up here, I found an article that you've written on your website about with 5 predictions of the future of psychotherapy.
I did, didn't I? That was a long time ago.
Yeah.
What did I say?
2003. Well, I thought you might have forgotten, because I know when I write something, Once it's out there, it's out of mind. So I'm prepared to prompt you. You made five predictions, and you can tell us a little bit about each of them. The first prediction was from pathology to creativity. What was that about?
Well, I think that was about the development, the recent work of positive psychology and the emphasis on not just positive psychology, mm-hmm. but working with issues like strengths-based, sort of strengths-based work, whether that's an organizational work or psychology, where you're looking more at resilience, how people succeed, what makes people overcome obstacles, and I think that's really, there's a big trend these days around not just looking at the roots and causes of problems, but how people actually surmount them and succeed or go on with life.
Yeah, that's a great prediction. I've had some guests from the positive psychology movement, and I totally agree with that prediction. Prediction number two.
I'm opening it up as we speak so I can be prepared. Okay.
From doctor-patient to partnership.
Right. I think that that's really borne out in a lot of areas. I think organizational learning and education itself, especially adult education, that this sort of hierarchical power-based relationship really interferes with learning, and that I think psychotherapy is beginning to reflect. I mean, it already has. I mean, I think something like the co-counseling movement or lots of different versions of psychotherapy are also dealing with this, mm-hmm. that there's probably going to be a move away from the sort of the doctor-patient expert.
Right. From therapist as expert to a more collaborative kind of relationship.
And I think also this is also a trend happening in healthcare where people are really being encouraged now to take responsibility for their own healthcare, and that there are hard, you know, results or empirical-based results that says that people who take more interest in and take leadership of their own healthcare are actually healthier.
Right. And your third prediction was titled Collapse of Individual Collective Dichotomy. I'm not sure what that means.
I'm not sure what I meant either. That's why you write. I think you write to get to work out what it is you're trying to think.
Exactly.
Sometimes you get there
exactly.
And sometimes you don't.
Well, people can go to the site and discover.
Right.
It's
they
on
can
your
let
website.
Me know. They can send me an email. Tell me what I meant. But I think when I look at it now, I think what I meant was that this, you know, you go to one-on-one psychotherapy, and then you go to work, or then you're in a group, and these things felt very separate.
Ah.
Where that psychotherapy was an individual endeavor, but then who you were in community or in group life was very separate. And I think that the sense that you go, that you get your healing in a private little room with one other person, is going to kind of end. That there's kind of more of a fluid boundary between who you are in one context and who you are in another.
Okay. And your fourth one was just-in-time therapy. I've heard of just-in-time manufacturing.
Right,
where nothing is held. Yeah, is warehoused, but it's created kind of as it's needed. How does that apply to therapy?
Well, you know, it's funny. For some people it works that you have a Thursday at 5 p.m. appointment, and then you go there at Thursday at 5 and you work on whatever it is you decide you want to work on. But for others, wouldn't it be cool that you sort of have like a 1-800 number just for a situation, that it becomes much more on the fly and less something separated and sort of compartmentalized off from the rest of your life, but you're actually able to kind of use facilitation on the spot where you need it.
That's interesting, so you see that as a trend, because you're right, particularly if you want to see somebody who's well-known, you know, like, okay, well, we can make an appointment for you 6 months from now or a year from now, we'll put you on the waiting list, and by then you got better on your own, or else you're in the loony bin.
it's true, unless, I mean, some people want to start therapy because they want to start the whole process of working on themselves, and that's different, but you're right, it actually did come from working with people who were very, very busy or had certain jobs where they really couldn't commit to that, but they really needed input sort of on the spot, and I found that a really exciting kind of client to work with.
Okay, now your fifth prediction is characterized as weirdness happens. How is that a prediction? Weirdness is happening already.
I know. I got to go back to this article. I think it needs some help. Let's see. I think I know what I meant. That it's already happening, and it's been happening for a while, but psychotherapy, you know, sort of the being judged against normal, I think, is really implicit in a lot of psychotherapy. And I think there's going to be a greater tolerance for individual benchmarks of what health is. And I hope that happens. So
in other words, weirdness is kind of universal. We're all weird in one way or another.
We're all weird. And to say what's healthy functioning and what's normal behavior in a given situation, I really hope that we, not just diversity, cultural diversity has really helped us understand that there's very varying understandings of what normal is relative culture to culture, but that also it's will an individual, you know, it's relative to who we are, and our own, as we say in process work, our own inner dreaming determines what's normal for us, and a greater understanding of that hopefully lies in our future.
That's a great place for us to wrap this up. Dr. Julie Diamond, thanks so much for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you, David. It's been a real pleasure talking with you this morning.
I hope you found this interview with Julie Diamond, PhD, enlightening. I'm going to keep my comments quite brief, inasmuch as the Christmas holiday has transpired between the time I recorded this interview and the time of my recording these comments. Consequently, whatever brilliant reflections I might have had right after the interview have flown the coop. I do remember a nice turn of phrase that Julie used when she said something along the lines of growing therapists as opposed to training them. I continue to be taken with that metaphor. As she suggests, I think you have to start out with good material, someone with natural talents as a listener, as an empathizer, as a healer, and then those natural talents need to be grown through encouragement, modeling, and other forms of nurturing. I also realize that I don't have much of a handle on the whole process work enterprise and what differentiates it from other approaches. So you can expect that there will be future shows on the same topic. And I will especially look forward to getting the word from the source this coming August when I interview Arnie and Amy Mendel themselves. I find myself especially interested to learn more about what they are calling world work, not only because it's so ambitious, but also because I'm at that point in life where I'd like to make an important contribution to the betterment of the planet myself.
Let us all come together to see what we can find. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you it's all in your mind. Let us all remember, what you seek is what you find. Dr. Davis here to remind you, it's all in your mind. Exploring our spirit and our psyche, we are learning to unwind. Shrink Wrap Radio is here to remind you, it's all in your mind. We're all in your mind. We're all in your mind.
My good friend Jerry Trumbull and I are planning to do yet another one of our Shrink Wrap Radio live episodes this Sunday, but at a new time. So jot down this information. The live call-in podcast will be this Sunday, December 30th at 6 p.m. Pacific Time. That's 7 p.m. for those in the Rocky Mountain West, 8 p.m. for those in the Central Time Zone in the American Midwest, and 9 p.m. for everyone on the East Coast. Those of you who are international, well, you'll just have to figure it out. We're hoping you'll join us there at www.blogtalkradio/shrinkwrapradio. And the call-in number is 646-595-4286. Be sure to register first so that your name will show up. The registration is free. It's a great opportunity for you to call in with your questions and comments, and we're hoping that with this new time, we might pick up some folks who haven't been able to make the earlier time. And if you can't join us for the live show, well, don't despair. It will be rebroadcast here, as usual. Now, if you haven't checked out our new website recently, please do so. It's been totally redesigned and upgraded to be color-coordinated with the new logo, and it has some new features. For example, the ability to scroll through all the past show titles on a single page. If you've only recently discovered Shrink Wrap Radio, you'll find that the first 50 or so shows no longer show up in the feed, but they are all available in the archives on our website for streaming or download. Let me remind you that if you're listening to this show but not subscribed, please do subscribe. It costs you nothing. On the right-hand side of each page at shrinkwrapradio.com is an icon that says Subscribe in iTunes. Just click on that, or you can subscribe at the podshow.com site, and there's a link to that on our page as well. Now, speaking of iTunes, we saw our biggest jump in listeners back when iTunes featured us on their podcast page, and there's no certain way to make that happen again, but one ingredient that does seem to help is getting as many positive reviews on the iTunes site as possible. So many of you have written with wonderful feedback. Can I get you to go to the iTunes store then to Shrink Wrap Radio and to leave some of those choice comments there if you haven't done so already? Many of you have, but if you haven't, that would be a great help. Thanks. And it's been a while since we've had any new additions to the Frapper map. You know how addicted I am to that. There's still many countries and states that are not represented. So if you haven't added yourself to the Frapper map yet, please do so, and you'll find a link to that on the website. The sponsors for this show are Podshow and GoDaddy. Remember to use the code SHRINK3 at checkout from GoDaddy to get a discount on your next domain name or web hosting purchase at GoDaddy. For example, I used GoDaddy to purchase psychologypodcast.com and then had them point it at Shrink Wrap Radio. Now, if anybody does a Google search looking for a psychology podcast, they're going to end up at Shrink Wrap Radio for sure. I'm certain you can come up with your own good uses for one or more domains from GoDaddy.
Hello, Dr. Dave. This is Brother Bernard Seif in Broadheadsville, Pennsylvania. I'm calling just to let everyone know that even monks listen to Shrink Wrap Radio. Thanks for the great podcasts.
Thank you very much for that transition, Brother Bernard. And it's been a long time since I've received a transition from anybody else out there. So, hey, if you've got a microphone that you can hook up to your computer, why not send us a nice little audio transition? So it's time for us to catch up with some email and continue our community building thereby. So first we hear from longtime listener in Israel, Anna, and the man who writes, "Hi, Dr. Dave. Every second Friday, my wife and I clean our apartment, and this is the time I listen to many podcasts. Today I heard Wise Counsel with Tony Madrid, which was good, but mostly a repetition of the one on Shrink Wrap Radio. And before that, I was in excited delight with your talk with Bob Altemeyer. It also struck me as very befitting that this interview should appear so shortly after the one with Stephen Baum, From Leadership to Authoritarians. It was an outstanding show again. I will write about it tomorrow." He's referring to writing about it on his blog. And he goes on, "By the way, yesterday, Tobin Hart's book arrived in the mail. What a great choice you've made for me. I'm reading it already. Many, many thanks. If you wonder why it took so long to arrive here, the parcel got damaged in the shipping. Fortunately, it was not too bad. I repaired the spine and cleaned the pages, and so it's good as new. Thanks again, Anna." Anna, I'm glad you got that book by Tobin Hart. I sent to Anna the Tobin Hart, you might recall, gave us a wonderful interview on the spirituality of children. And that was a little bit of a hard book for me to let go of because I was so touched by both by the interview and by the book. But Anna's been a special friend and listener here to Shrink Wrap Radio, and so I thought it appropriate. I've had a couple of packages of books that I sent out that were damaged, and the packaging that I was using was simply too frail. I was going on the cheap, so now I've got some better envelopes that should work better. So I hope you enjoy that book, Anna. I know that you will. Then we got a nice long email from Susan, I believe, here, who has been tuning in to our live podcasts. And so she wrote, Dave, and please forward to Jerry. First, my thanks to Jerry for his interest and kind words about my blog. Indeed, one goal of writing this blog is to convey to the still sighted people some of the emotions of vision loss. But mostly I tried to portray the ways technology and media, like your podcasts, really, really help and how lucky I feel that this stuff is available just when I need it. I think you can tell by the context here that Susan is struggling with some vision challenges. And so it's wonderful that there is a medium like podcasting. I can see where that would really be a great thing. She goes on to say, unfortunately, the Blog Talk Radio chat room seems to be off limits to me. Accessibility is a combination of design, technology, implementation, assistive tools, and user skill. I choose to use a free open source screen reader, which I think will soon replace the $1,000 plus tools promulgated by rehab organizations. The screen reader and my still developing skills may be remiss, but I strongly suspect the chat room implementation is just unreadable, sadly. The website as a whole is congested with advertising. That makes it hard to use, although probably technically accessible. Bottom line, Blog Talk Radio is a bummer for me. And I know that there are accessible chats, for example, accessibleworld.org. So I'm really sorry to hear that, Susan, but presumably you can still listen to those shows. And certainly you can listen to them in the feed here. She says, hey, here are some topics I wonder about. First, the teenage brain. When and how does it mature? I have a couple of little buggers living with me, and they keep me guessing what's next. Well, that's a good topic. We haven't done a whole lot on developmental psychology, so I'll keep that in mind. She goes on to say, second, you and Jerry were talking about psychological research then and now, changes in research methods, norms, publications, etc. might interest some of us. I chuckle that when I did my thesis in the early 1970s, research summary took about an afternoon, and most research was groundbreaking. I'm glad I got into computer science early and can appreciate how fields evolve. Third, she writes, my special other teaches robotics and artificial intelligence as a unit in a freshman philosophy course at Santa Monica College. The students are introduced to the mind-body issues in the context of the history of philosophy and then have a goal at building a chatbot, playing with robots, and exploring expert systems. I have to say parenthetically here, boy, what an interesting course. I wish I had had a class like that as an undergraduate. She goes on to say, this is a way to recruit more students into computing as well as liven up philosophy. By the way, my minor in college was philosophy. I really liked philosophy. And to me, psychology just seemed like applied philosophy. Back to Susan, who writes, is there an authority who could pull together all these threads to give 20-year-old students a preview of, and then it kind of loses the thought, a preview of, I guess, AI and so on. And she goes on to say, I like the Sunday time slot. Thanks again to Jerry for feedback and encouragement. And that's Susan. Oh, I see part got cut off here. Is there an authority who could pull together all these threads to give 20-year-olds a preview of the singularity and dualism as a part of their education? Somehow that got scrambled up. Okay, let's move on. This one is from Stuart. Stuart writes, it's been another good shrink wrap year, so congratulations to you and a very happy Christmas. In summary, it surprised me, as I know nothing about psychology, etc., that I'm now in my third year of listening and am always entertained and learning. Now, with your energy and experiments of 2007, for example, exhibition interviews, live radio, t-shirts, books, and a tolerance of the extremes, has by added color to the dialogue, and I'm sure will allow it to still further grow in 2008. Some book lists for each category would be useful, as this is developing into a very interesting source of reference. Thanks for the continuing education, Stuart. P.S. The sound quality is fine. That's great to know that the sound is good, finally, after many ups and downs. Stuart, thanks so much for that encouragement and for your noticing all the changes and developments and experimentation that I have been involved in here. And as for reading lists, that's a great idea. Of course, many of these interviews are with authors, and so you have a bit of a reading list there if you go after the author's books. And in the early interviews, I always used to ask for some book recommendations. I realize I have not been doing that so much recently. Okay, the next one, a nice long one from Kai, who writes, "Dear Dr. Dave, I'm a new fan of your show, so first off, let me say thanks. It's highly entertaining and informative." Yeah, I love to have new fans. I mean, you know, people get tired of listening to the same podcast over and over, I think. And I know sometimes I drift away from some podcasts. So it's important that we have new people joining us, as some people, I presume, fall away. I hope they come back. So again, he says, "I'm a new fan of your show. So first off, let me say thanks. It's highly entertaining and informative. So I had a couple of ideas for future shows." Yeah, I know you probably have enough of these already. And a technical note. My first idea comes from, well, shows like yours. I've listened regularly to a few different netcasts, podcasts, and radio shows, but both now and in the past. I've noticed that after hearing a host often enough, I kind of feel like I know them. I couldn't tell you anything about them as people, what they like or what they are like, and of course they've never even heard of me. But if somebody insults them in their shows, I'll argue back, not just to defend myself as a listener, but to defend the hosts themselves. From the way that people talk when they call into radio shows, I get the impression that I'm not alone in this. Why is that? Does hearing a voice a lot just trick some social bit of our brains? Is it weird to feel like I know someone that I actually don't? I guess you can sum up the idea here as the psychology of podcasts. I think that's a really interesting area that you've raised here, Kai, and this is one I hope to explore. I tried to explore it when I was interviewing podcasters live at the Podcaster and New Media Expo, but of course they weren't psychologists, and I couldn't get everyone to kind of engage with that idea. I do think there's something about the human voice, and you know, many people are probably listening to these podcasts through earphones or earbuds, which means that the voice of the podcaster, it's kind of right next to their brain. So I think it does get in there, and I know what you're talking about. I'm a fan of several podcasters myself, and I kind of feel like I have a personal relationship with them, although they're probably unaware of that. Back to Kai's note, he says, "And hey, self-reference is a very trendy modern Web 2.0 sort of thing to do. My second idea is Schizoid, but not really a show about Schizoid itself. I'm more interested in the questions it raises. A disorder which doesn't harm the victim, doesn't cause them to harm anyone else, and doesn't involve any breaks with reality. Is that even a disorder? And if the answer is yes, are there people who say no? Are the people who say no misinformed or just using bad logic? If the answer is no, why and how did it get labeled as a disorder? Is there an opposite version where instead of being so introverted, it's a disorder, a person is far too extroverted? How can narcissism be both its own disorder and a symptom of schizoid?" Well, there are a lot of good questions there, Kai, and you know, I'm not really up on the whole schizoid thing. I always found that category kind of off-putting, and I'm not even sure if it's in the current DSM, and I don't have a copy to check. Maybe some listener will let me know. I sort of think it might have kind of gone by the way, but that could be wishful thinking on my part. Back to Kai again. And finally, an off-topic technical note. Your co-host on the last live show was wondering where the lag or delay comes from if electricity travels at the speed of light. I don't actually know what speed it does travel at, and you're probably right about resistance in the wires, but the literal speed isn't really the issue. Bandwidth is. Bandwidth is how much data can travel on a connection at one time. It's like how many lanes a road has as opposed to how fast the cars are moving. This is why the speed of connections is given in an amount of data per time, kilobits or kilobytes per second, rather than distance per time, miles per hour, or how it compares to the speed of light or something. It's also why some connections are so much faster than others. Yes, and we had another listener, I think it might have been Anna, who pointed out that the data is communicated in packets. And so the whole issue of packetizing and prioritizing of packets would also affect the speed. And then finally, Kai says, oh, and I would be a big fan of moving the live show to an earlier or much later time or to Saturday. There's my vote. So, Kai, I hope you're listening, and it's going to be at a later time this Sunday at 6 p.m. So that's a few minutes of your life you're not getting back, he says, for which I apologize. Thanks again for the show, Kai. And Kai, thank you. And next we hear from Italia. Hello, Dr. Dave. My name is David Nahum. I'm a psychologist from Italy, and I'm a big fan of Shrink Wrap Radio. How exciting that is for me, both that a psychologist is a fan and somebody from Italy, because I love Italy. I've been there twice. I would like to go there much more. He writes, I started to listen to your show some months ago, and now I'm addicted to your show. I walk through Milan listening to the psychological impact of materialism or the effect of Qigong on mental health. I also have a side effect. I'm improving my English. Well, maybe you cannot notice from this email, but I assure you it is better than before. Well, it's quite good. Much better than my Italian, I must say. He goes on, I'm writing you because besides the compliments, I would like to do something like Shrink Wrap Radio in Italy, of course, in the Italian language. I'm building a website, and I think it's important to share some psychological issues with the common people who are interested in psychology but cannot find serious information on the topic. In Italy, we have some TV psychologists, as we do here in the U.S., I might add, who go to TV shows and tell the audience very obvious remarks. I would like to ask you for some suggestions, some tips or tricks for the upcoming show. My idea is to do something like what you do, for example, interviews with psychologists and maybe some podcasts with interviews and some without, but with some lecture on topics of my own interest, for example, learning disorders, cognitive enhancement, cognitive therapy, just to name a few. Best regards and happy Christmas, Davida. Well, Davida, imitation is the sincerest form of flattery, so I would just say do what I do, only do it in Italian. And if you need any help or technical information, do send me emails and I'll be happy to answer any questions that you have. By the way, I'm not sure if Davida is a male or a female name. I've said his and him throughout, but I have this lingering feeling that Davida might be a woman. So please accept my apologies for my ignorance in this regard. And so I think that better wrap it up for today. We're running a little bit long here. So remember, you can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can also leave voice transitions and voice comments for me in the voicemail area on Skype, where my name is ShrinkPod. You can also leave voice messages on my Chingo, and you'll find a link to that on the website. Or you can leave voicemail and transitions on our phone at 206-337-0622. So remember, the next podcast is just a couple days from now with my good friend Jerry Trumbull. Don't know what we'll be talking about, but it will be Sunday, December 30th. At 6 p.m. Pacific time, and I hope you can make it. This is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.